welcome to the ICE at Dartmouth podcast. This is Franklin Jacoby. Today, I'm going to talk with Dr. Damian Sawinski about information theory. This quite technical theory has been of central importance for computing and communication, especially for packaging information into a digital format that can be efficiently transported between computers and people. But information theory is connected to a number of other important topics and may prove useful in a number of other applications. It may help us, for example, quantify more precisely how strongly we believe something when faced with limited evidence. It might also offer a path to thinking more precisely about a number of scientific problems ranging from astronomy to molecular and cellular biology. I'm going to first talk with Damian about what information theory is, and then about how it might be connected to some of these other topics. Damian is a research fellow at the Thayer School of Engineering at Dartmouth College. He has wide-ranging interests in astronomy, physics, and mathematics, just to name a few areas. And he currently works on developing better imaging technology for medical applications. You've worked on a number of different things, but I suppose what's tying them all together is information theory. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Information theory, I guess, is the common thread in everything. Coming from a physics background and astrophysics background in undergrad, I was not familiar with information theory. That's kind of like the realm of CS, computer science. And I was just sort of like, we're using this measure, but I don't know what information is. For me, this is just a formula that I'm applying. So that caused me to do a really deep dive into trying to figure out, well, what in the world is information theory? Yeah, that ended up turning into kind of like an obsession, because information theory is really, really interesting. You could say that it kind of started with Claude Shannon's A Mathematical Theory of Communication. Yeah, so Claude Shannon wrote this, and he was really interested in communication. I mean, that's the name of the paper, The Mathematical Theory of Communication. So he wanted to know, how do you send, you know, words, how do you send information from a sender to a receiver through some sort of a channel? And this is a very, very general definition of communication, because right now I am a sender, you are receiving the information. The channel, there are actually multiple channels involved here. I am producing sound waves that are leaving my mouth. So there is the air channel that these sound waves propagate through. Then those sound waves are, there are multiple receivers and senders, because the first receiver is the microphone, right? The microphone then has to translate those sound waves into some sort of digital impulses. Then there's the entire framework of Zoom and the internet that somehow sends those signals to your speaker. And then your speaker has to decode those and turn them into sound waves so that you can finally get them. And then your brain is somehow decoding these like globbity globs that are coming out of my mouth into meaningful sentences that you're trying to follow. That was the entire process that Shannon tried to explain or discuss, formalize. Was how communication is done over a channel. And he was worried with two different types of channels. He was worried with both, he thought about both noisy and noiseless channels. So a noiseless channel is one in which, you know, the globbity glob that comes out of my mouth, that like is perfectly what the receiver ends up getting. And then there's noisy channels that might, you know, have like static. It's like communicating with someone at a loud bar. There's noise in the background and you have to repeat yourself a few times and that's a noisy channel. Even in the case of the noiseless channel, though, it's like you can still sort of start to, I guess, get a feeling for the meaning information. So there, Shannon was able to write down an expression known as the Shannon entropy. There are so many different ways to interpret what Shannon entropy is, some probably better than others. In fact, configurational entropy is a slight modification of the original Shannon formula. But the Shannon entropy basically describes, tries to quantify the amount of information in a particular alphabet, in a set of symbols that are used for communication. So communication is built out of the use of individual tidbits of meaning that are usually encoded in sound or letters or whatever. Some of those letters, some of those sounds tend to appear a lot more often than others do. And so let me think of an example here, like the letter E in the English alphabet, right? Letter E is the most common letter in the English alphabet. If you're playing hangman with someone, what's one of the letters you're going to guess first?
E.
E, right? Because it's most likely going to appear somewhere in the statement, right? So
I suppose you could say general things about how non-random the signal is going to I shouldn't say signal yet, but maybe how non-random the arrangement of different elements of the alphabet or the symbol system.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of it. All the symbols were equally likely, that's actually a maximum amount of entropy. So Shannon's entropy measure is maximal there because you literally have an equal probability of any letter being in the hangman game or in the stream of communication that is happening. Rarer letters, though, tend to have more information associated with them, right? If you see an X in the game of hangman, like your brain's going to go straight to, xylophone or six or, other words, the few words that you know that all have X's in them. Whereas if you see an E, that's really not going to, it's not too informative because, right, there's lots of words that have E's. E shows up in a lot of places. So things that are more probable are less informative. Things that are less probable are more informative. I better have said that correctly. Low probability, higher information content. High probability, low information content. Just going about day-to-day life, it's really those things that are improbable that you take notice of because they're informative. You're not really too surprised when, the sun starts rising in the morning because it happens all the time, every single day. Sure, it might tell you, that it's exactly sunrise, but it's nowhere near as informative as, what's another good example? Sorry, I'm like totally blanking here on possible examples to use.
It's hard to come up with examples. I suppose if there's like an eclipse or something.
Yeah, exactly. Much, much more informative. Like, why is that happening? Why is it so rare? Right, exactly. So, with in Shannon's context, it's these low probability letters or events that are highly informative, and the high probability ones that should be less informative. And this ties in directly with compression. So how data such as sound or visual pictures are communicated digitally through computers, you have to somehow convert this stream of sound that I'm creating into bits that then get moved around through the computer. Turns out that if you use fewer bits for the really for the probable stuff, like you encode E, the letter E, with as few bits as possible, and you encode encode X or Z with many more bits, then overall, on average, you will be able to compress a data stream much better than if you use the same number of bits for every single letter. Right? You could think, oh, I have 26 letters, so 26 is close to 32, which is 2^8, so I need like 8 bits to encode every single letter. And you could do that. You could make A, you know, 0000001. I think that was like 7 zeros and then a 1, right? And then you can make B 000, and then 10, and then 11 for C, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then you can start sending, you know, texts, books through this encoding, and you'll find that you're sending bits at a certain rate, right? Maybe your channel can only support, you know, 1,000 bits per second. It's not a lot, but let's say that's what it is, right? Then 1,000 divided by 8 is, you know, whatever that is right now. I'm not going to do division super quickly, but that's how many bits you'd be sending how many letters you'd be sending per second. And you might find that, you know, that's not fast enough for you. If instead you encode the probable letters like E in a small number of bits and the improbable ones with a larger number of bits, then you can show that you can actually send more letters every single second through a particular channel. And so Shannon was able to show that the Shannon entropy is kind of like the optimal, the best possible rate at which you can send bits of information through a particular channel. So there's kind of like one particular way of starting to think about information. Information maybe is like a tangible thing. It's an encoding of meaning into the physical substrate. In this case, we're encoding the meaning into digital bits, zeros and ones, and moving them from one place to another place. And And if we encode them using Shannon's formula for entropy, then our encoding will be optimal in the sense that we will be able to send the most number of letters via the bit stream that we have available for us in the channel that we're using. And you can ask similar questions about like languages. Like languages have a bunch of letters, vowels. Notice how vowels are like very short, like ah, eh, uh. We can construct them very quickly with our mouths when we say them, as opposed to like k or k or slightly longer sounds. And because vowels are peppered everywhere in our language, it's optimal for any language that evolves to sort of have the shortest sound sequence to use for vowels. What other places can I think of here? Language. Hey, you could look at, for instance, not just letters in an alphabet, but letters are used to make words. Words are used to make sentences, so on and so forth. So you not only have to look at the probability that certain letters occur in a language, but you can also look at the probability that letters follow other letters that are already in a message. Like for instance, if you were playing Hangman and you saw the letter Q on the board, what would you guess next?
I would guess you.
Yeah, exactly. So that one's kind of an easy one because, you know, there are only like, what, three words or something that have a Q without a U in them in the English language. One of them is like the old spelling of cat with like Q-A-T or I don't even remember at this point. But you know that U's follow Q's. So a Q is informing you what the next letter should be. So you can learn basically these transition probabilities for letters, like what letters follow a letter, what letters tend to follow two letters, what letters tend to follow three letters, and get a transition probability matrix for, you know, how one, what letters should follow any particular stream of past letters. This is actually, it was another one of the first things that Shannon did was to try to figure out what is the entropy of the English language, to see like on average, how many bits is every single letter, is every single letter using, as it's being sent, averaged not just over letters, but over words and sentences as well. That's actually a big area of research, is trying to figure out the entropy of languages. What makes some languages, you know, have all languages sort of evolved to be as optimal as possible, to be using the sounds that are available to the speakers to try to convey meaning as quickly as possible? Or are there things that can still be tweaked? These different vowel shifts and consonant shifts that occur in languages, might they be the result of a optimization procedure over time, where simply users of the language are trying to be more efficient? Okay, right. So language is interesting. Alphabets are interesting. Claude, Shannon, super interesting. So I started to learn about what is this formula that we're using? What is the Shannon entropy? That led to another hole, because we started talking about probability, the probability of a particular letter occurring is related to its information content. And that's a whole other super interesting story of like, what in the world do we really mean by probability? And when you're describing letters here, you may have a book that's full of words, and you can use this Shannon idea of information to then figure out what the probability distribution over letters and words are, and figure out the information content of the book. But you know, maybe the book is in, I don't know, Dutch. I don't speak Dutch. There's no information in this book for me. It's just a bunch of symbols. Whereas for a Dutch speaker, there is tons of information inside that book. So Shannon's definition is kind of agnostic to the type of information. He was more concerned with just looking at patterns in an alphabet, right? Whereas information to me felt a lot more like it's, you know, subjective because of like this example that I just used. Everyone is going to have is going to be able to extract a different amount of information from a message, such as an encyclopedia or a book or a podcast. So information can't just be this objective quantity that's based on the probability of letters. There has to be some sort of interaction between the subject and the object that information lives there somewhere in that interaction between a subject perceiving the world and extracting information from it. That was something that I kind of really needed to understand. How does the subject fit into all of this? And that brought me to, I guess, the foundations of probability theory and what we mean by probability. There are two big schools, there's more than two schools, but there are two very big schools of interpreting probability. There's the frequentist school and the Bayesian school of probability. And Shannon's work is very much based on a frequentist description of probability. For a frequentist, probabilities are objective results of experiments under the assumption that, you know, you could perform the experiment an infinite number of times. So when they say that a coin has a probability of 1/2 of showing up heads, what a frequentist tends to imagine is frequencies. They tend to imagine, oh, throwing a coin and it pops up heads, throwing it again, it pops up tails. Doing that and listing the number of heads and tails, and finding the ratio of heads to the total number of flips, and doing that, you know, ad infinitum to get some sort of a limiting value, which is the probability of 1/2. That's the frequentist interpretation of probability. And it works great when you first start learning about probability, because you can start talking about, you know, decks of cards and suits and throwing die and, you know, all these little experiments that you could repeat over and over and over again. But, you know, as when you get done with those simple types of experiments, you might also ask yourself, you know, other types of questions involving the colloquial use of the word probability. Things like, what is the probability of life on Mars? What's the probability that it'll rain tomorrow? With the latter question, that could still be kind of brought into a frequentist context if you have lots of historical data for the exact same day, for the same region in the world, you might be able to come up with some sort of frequentist way of saying that. But then when it comes to questions like, what is the probability of life on Mars? I mean, what are you gonna do? You're not gonna go out there and like make a bajillion Marses and then check that one and be like, oh, there's life on that one. And oh, no life on that one, no life on that one. And then, you know, add up how many times you found life versus how many times you didn't find life and get like a ratio. That's just ludicrous. It's like a stupid way to extend the frequentist interpretation of probability to these much richer, this much richer field of questions that seem like you could at least in language use the word probability to try to describe. So if you can't use the frequentist definition in like that case, then what does it really mean when we ask what is the probability of life on Mars? And that's really fascinating because probability there, the word is almost a stand-in for the question or for the word belief. Like how much do you believe there is life on Mars? And of course, if you were to ask any Joe Schmo on the street what they believe is the state of life on Mars, then you'd probably get lots of different answers. Some yes, some no, some ahs. But they would not be, They would not be well-informed. You trust the answers to these types of questions from individuals who have the correct prior information to be able to judge that belief, right? You're not going to ask, your cash register person at a store, like, so what do you think my chances are if like this cancer comes back? Right, you're going to go and ask the doctor, like that the oncologist that studies cancer, hey, what do you think my chances are? Because you trust that their belief is more informed than the average person's, and is giving you a closer approximation to the true chance, the true probability of a particular thing happening. And even to say that the true probability, you know, once again, for frequency things, you can say that there's an objective probability, but, you know, if something either is or isn't going to happen, and then it either does or it doesn't, what does it even mean to say that there was a particular probability that that thing would happen?
Yeah, nothing to compare it to. It's just a one-off event.
Yeah, exactly. So so the Bayesian school of probability is more entrenched in this idea that probabilities are beliefs. Probabilities are the strength with which we believe particular statements are either true or false. And as you know, a student, I was originally very well versed with the frequentist version of probability. You can go down that rabbit hole. There's this set of what are known as the Kolmogorov axioms that describe probability theory in this very frequentist sense of simply getting ratios of things happening, things not happening to compute probabilities. But I found that this notion of belief is much more interesting because it's closer to that subject-object divide that I was starting to sniff out in information theory. So I started to dive into this interpretation of probability theory. And as with all things, the instant you start doing research, you find out that many people much smarter than you have already thought about this, and usually it was 100 years ago. And that happened to me. I found quite a bit of literature on the Bayesian interpretation of probability. But what really got me was these papers by Richard Threckland Cox, which came out somewhere around like halfway through the last century. The main paper was the algebra of probable belief, if I remember the name, probably. Yeah, I think that's correct. Richard there was interested in trying to create a algebra for belief, basically trying to formalize the notion of what it means to believe something and to create a formal system of symbols that you can then use to play around with beliefs on a piece of paper to kind of create this mapping between belief and mathematics. And he based his theory on three axioms, three rules that he thought were very straightforward, and the consequences of those axioms were able to capture a lot of the phenomenology that he wanted to capture. And so there you have to sort of think of beliefs in the Coxian sense as mappings from statements to strengths of belief, to beliefs. You can believe in things strongly, you could believe in something weakly, but the idea is that the thing that you're believing in or not believing in is a statement. It's a statement in some sort of a language. That statement could be, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. You could have a certain amount of belief in that, or it could be, you know, that over there is a cat. And even though the statement itself, that over there is a cat, is either true or false, the subject that is hearing the statement, you know, may not be in a position to fully verify the truthfulness of that statement, which is where beliefs kick in, right? It's not about the statement itself being true or false. It's about the subject's how much they believe. I keep reusing the same word, belief. Their credence in the statement. The strength with which they think the statement is true. That was sort of Cox's notion of a belief. And so, right, he had three axioms. The first axiom was that beliefs are transitive. That already like brings up a bunch of math, but this one's super easy. If there are three statements and you believe A more than you believe B, and you believe B more than you believe C, then beliefs should work in a way that you believe A more than you believe C.
Seems intuitive. Seems reasonable.
Seems right. Common sense, right? Yeah. So this transitivity is a awesome property because it means that you can any set of objects that obey this transitive property, you can map them to the real numbers. So basically with that axiom, he was able to then say, all right, beliefs are numbers, right? What types of the real numbers? Now what the range of those numbers is, you know, that haven't said anything about it. All that we're saying is that you can represent beliefs with real numbers because real numbers are transitive and beliefs should obey this transitive property. His second and third axiom. So the second axiom was kind of hand wavy. It was the axiom of common sense. And it just said that beliefs should change in the system in a reasonable way. If you compute a belief system, then it should resemble something that happens in reality in epistemology and how people think. So kind of a hand wavy one. The third one was consistency. And consistency was sort of the glue that held it all together, because it basically said that whatever the rules of combining beliefs are, they need to gel with the underlying formal system that is being used, the language that is being used by the subject, the epistemic agent, the thinking thing. So the easiest example is zeroth order logic. Propositional logic. You not only have statements like this is a cat or no, it is raining, but you can also create conjunctions, you know, this is a cat and it is raining. You can create negations, that is not a cat, or disjunctions, that is a cat or it is raining. So there's lots of different logical connectives that can then be constructed to combine statements together. And when you the rules for combining beliefs together should follow, gel with, not contradict the underlying logic of the language that is being used to express those beliefs on, that the beliefs are being expressed on. So, like I said, that one glued it together. He only studied the case propositional logic. He was able to examine what the belief functions are, what they do, and then he made sure that they gel properly with negation. In other words, the belief in the statement A is somehow related to your belief in the statement not A. So my belief in it is raining is somehow related to my belief in it is not raining. So every statement and its negation the beliefs on top of both of those statements should be connected in a particular way.
That's very tidy. That's nice. It sounds like a neat way of getting an interesting result from combining those Shannon's work and Bayesian statistics.
Right. Exactly. It's great because now you can start applying these ideas from information theory to epistemology. Another neat way of, if we go back to information theory and possible interpretations of what the Shannon entropy means, sure, it's a way of finding the information in all the symbols in an alphabet. It's also the not necessarily the information in all the symbols. It's more like the average information over all the symbols in an alphabet. And when I'm speaking about things in a very frequentist way here, to sort of give you a better Bayesian interpretation of entropy, I like to think of it in terms of questioning. So if you have, you know, an epistemic agent, a thinking thing, and they are given several options. Let me first say a slightly other example, and then maybe that will help me be able to say this example in a slightly more eloquent way. If I gave you 10 boxes and said that there's a ball inside of one of them, then a particular question that would be relevant in that example is, what is the average number of questions you have to ask in order to identify where the ball is? Okay. And let's say that they're only yes or no questions, i.e. bits, zeros and ones. The Shannon entropy is actually the optimal number of questions then that need to be asked in order to identify the where the ball is. You can think of lots of different strategies here. Like, for instance, you could say, well, I could just check the boxes sequentially. And if you do that, then if there's 10 boxes, the average number of questions that you'll end up asking is like somewhere around 5. Because sometimes the ball will be in the first box and you'll get it with one question. Other times it might be in the last box and you'll have gone through 10 questions. And so it's an average of, you know, 1 through 10 questions. There's a much more efficient strategy, which is to take the 10 boxes and subdivide them into two groups and then ask, is the ball in this group or is it in this group? And then you only have half as many to look into with the next question. And you can once again divide it into two groups and say, is it in this group or that group? And you will always get down to the answer in a log n, in this case, logarithm of 10, number of questions relative to the first case where you have to ask more questions. This technique is actually used in what's known as merge sort. It's a particular type of sorting algorithm. I'm fairly certain I got that one right. Sometimes I misremember names, but in a computer, you might be searching for a particular thing inside of a list, and you have to identify where in the list it is. Computers do this all the time. If you just do your standard searching algorithm of going through each box separately, then you end up spending a lot more time doing these searches, slowing down the computer for whatever else it needs to do. Whereas if you use this merge sort, this divide technique, divide into two parts, then you can find the object in the list much quicker and much more efficiently. A lot of computer science is actually figuring out these types of optimal ways, optimal algorithms for accessing information, manipulating information. And a lot of those are based off of bounds that come from information theory, where information theory tells us that, you know, there is an optimal way to do this, and this will be how optimal it is. Whether or not we know the optimal strategy, however, is what a lot of research focuses on. So that's like a good Bayesian interpretation of information. We now have seen a Bayesian interpretation of probability. It is the strength of belief that an epistemic agent has in a particular event outcome, in a particular statement, the outcome of a particular statement. Information is then related to the number of questions that can be asked, that must be asked by the subject in order to validate the statement, find out the answer to it. Even that, though, you know, we're counting things, it's starting to sound more like a frequentist interpretation than a Bayesian one. So with my research, and what part of my thesis was really trying to get at understanding what information is solely in these subjective epistemological terms, without having to bring up counting or any sort of frequentist ideas there. That was always a really like important, and still is like an important way to, I guess, discuss what's happening in nature and reality. There's two separate narratives that scientists tend to make concerning the world. One of them is a physical narrative. That's kind of like describing what's happening physically. This is what the atoms are doing. This is what the molecules are doing. It involves things like free energy, energy barriers, catalyzing reactions, all of these words to build a picture of what's happening inside, for example, a cell. The information narrative is different in that it tries to follow what's happening to the information structures. If you're looking at a cell, it's might not be the best to describe, oh, you know, the DNA is breaking apart at, you know, these particular bases, and then the ribosomes are coming over here and grabbing more adenosine or more guanine and adding it to this side or that side. But having a narrative that discusses the way in which the information in the DNA is first transcribed into RNA, then it is translated from the RNA into proteins, and then discussing what those proteins end up doing, is a much more concise way of describing the workings of a cell in terms of this informational narrative. You're talking about what is happening to the information. The information was originally, you know, written in the DNA. Then something had to like transcribe the writing in the DNA into RNA. And then once it was transcribed, right, the cell needs to figure out a way to translate this information so that in the end, you know, there's this communication channel between, you know, the parts of the cell that get the information from the DNA into working proteins that will then do whatever it is that they need to do. Right? Because that's exactly what living things end up doing. They end up using the free energy in their environments to decrease the entropy in their environments. I mean, I clean my room on a daily basis, and well, maybe not on a daily basis, quarantine, but I do so. I generate heat, but I also generate information about like where the different things are in the room. There is currently research being done in biology that looks at the heat generated by gates inside of cells. So gates that typically allow one type of molecule or protein in or out to sort of see how much heat is generated and what sort of information is being gathered by the cell. There's a connection between information theory, information, order, disorder, stability, instability, and life and death. They're all sort of maybe pointing at a narrative that synthesizes both the informational aspects and the physical aspects of what's happening into a better way, or maybe the only way, to properly describe life. This is me totally philosophizing at this point.
That was great stuff. I mean, it's a really, I think, nice explanation of information and, I mean, a lot of, I think, quite technical stuff.
Thanks for listening. I'm grateful to everyone at ICE at Dartmouth and to Damian Sawinski for making this episode possible. We listen to The Wonder of Science by Lexin Music. Stay tuned for more episodes and check ice.dartmouth.edu. Thank you.